a moment ago when he was introducing. But what I heard him say was this: I'm glad Andrew's preaching that text, not me. See, I'm nodding his head. Two Sundays ago, we began a series of sermons, 16 in total, that will take us through the book of Romans. And when Mike introduced that 2 weeks ago, we were reminded of the fact that Romans is one of the most difficult letters to read and to understand in the New Testament. In fact, Mike said that even in ancient literature, Romans stands out as one of those letters, one of those pieces of writing that is a complex and difficult piece to wade through. And I think all three of us had some sense that even in 16 sermons, we're biting off a whole lot more than we can chew. And I certainly experienced that this week preparing for this section, which begins at verse 18 of chapter 1 and takes us through to chapter 3, verse 20. I'm not going to read all those verses, but do want to reflect particularly on the latter half of chapter 1 and some of the parts in chapters 2 and 3 as well. I think it's important to bridge what Paul says in verses 16 and 17 of chapter 1 with what he then goes on to say in verse 18. Because if you will remember from 2 weeks ago, verse 16 and 7 serve as a kind of crescendo, a kind of wonderful climax in terms of capturing the essence of what Paul is going to say in his letter to the Romans. 16 and 17 serve as a powerful thematic climax, which we do well to remind ourselves of as we then move into verse 18 and following. And so if you have your Bibles open, turned to 16 and 17 of chapter 1, let me read it to you as you read from Eugene Peterson's The Message, as a way of bringing a fresh word into the scriptures that you hear this morning. Paul writes, "It's news I'm most proud to proclaim. I'm not ashamed of the gospel. This extraordinary message of God's powerful plan to rescue everyone who trusts him, starting with Jews and then right on to everyone else. God's way of putting people right shows up in the acts of faith, confirming what Scripture has said all along. The person in right standing before God by trusting him really lives." To summarize, Paul is saying the good news has been revealed. The good news that Jesus Christ has announced, the Messiah, the Christ, the news that Jesus has announced and embodied in himself is true. Jesus is King, Jesus is Lord, and has put into plan a new age which will usher in the renewal and restoration of all things. A power from God has come, announced by Jesus, demonstrated in his death and in his resurrection, that salvation, rescue, is available for all who will believe. This is good news, because we see all around us evidence that the world is not the way it's supposed to be. And Paul, in a wonderful crescendo, says God has done something about it in Jesus Christ. And then he moves to the next section, beginning at verse 18. "This God, who is deeply faithful to the promise he made long ago through Abraham and to his descendants, that God was going to bring blessing and restoration to all the nations of the earth. This faithful God, who has entered into relationship with humanity, is angry at the way humanity's pride and sin has allowed creation to come undone. We We don't like the thought of an angry God. In fact, for many, the wrath of God that they say is an Old Testament picture, well, clearly it's not. For we encounter God's anger in many places in the New Testament as well. But frequently it has been said this concept of an angry God is something that we need to get beyond. In fact, very learned Christian scholars have wrestled with it. One such theologian is a gentleman by the name of Miroslav Wolf, a Croatian theologian who grew up in the former Yugoslavia. And in one of his books called Free of Charge, he speaks about his own wrestling with this notion of God as an angry God. He says, the thought that the idea of an angry God to me was barbaric, completely unworthy of a God of love. But then my country experienced a brutal war. People committed terrible atrocities against their neighbors and countrymen. My last resistance to the idea of God's wrath was a casualty of the war in the former Yugoslavia, where I come from. According to some estimates, 200,000 people were killed and over 3 million were displaced. My villages and cities were destroyed. My people shelled day in and day out. Some of them brutalized beyond imagination. I could not imagine God not being angry. Or think of Rwanda in the last decade or the past century, where 800,000 people were hacked to death in 100 days. How did God react to the carnage? By doting on the perpetrators in a grandfatherly fashion? By refusing to condemn the bloodbath, but instead affirming the perpetrators' basic goodness? Wasn't God fiercely angry with them? Though I used to complain about the indecency of the idea of God's wrath, I came to think that I would have to rebel against a God who wasn't wrathful at the sight of the world's evil. God isn't wrathful in spite of being love. God is wrathful because he is love. It strikes me we do well to have this picture of God in our minds as we listen to the way in which Paul unfolds a description of how sinful humanity rebelled against the good God who made them. God, in his goodness, throughout the created world, Paul says, has revealed his divine power and his eternal nature. God has revealed himself to all humanity simply in the created order, in the vastness of the universe, in its beauty and its majesty, in the careful design of creation, in the awesome power of creation, in the intricate detail of creation. God has revealed his eternal power and his divine nature, says Paul. And it is true. Increasingly, as we become more and more familiar with the intricacy and the detail of the created order, we see that some design, some intelligence must be present. For the hypothesis that this was an accident, the result of some chance explosion billions of years ago, increasingly seems, well, a lie. In one of his books, Scott Jose shares the story, a quotation actually, of a famous British astronomer and also a self-proclaimed atheist. This astronomer by the name of Fred Hoyle and his research partner, Willie Fowler, discovered that the difference between, among other things, the difference between there being sufficient carbon to produce life in the universe and there being no carbon at all is a matter of the narrowest of margins, he says. Had the situation in the early universe been different by as little as 0.5%, virtually no carbon would be in existence. Although an atheist, Hoyle has admitted that nothing ever shook his atheism quite like the discovery of how precisely everything had to come together just to yield carbon atoms. A quote from him: "Would you not say to yourself, in the light of this finding, some super calculating intellect must have designed the properties of the carbon atom, otherwise the chance of my finding such an atom through the blind forces of nature would be utterly minuscule?" Of course you would. A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics, as well as with chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to be so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. And yet, to his dying day, he remained a committed atheist. Though many have said this atheist was one that seemed to open the door to the concept of an intelligent design behind an evolutionary process. You know, when I listen to that story, I can't help but hear Paul's words in Romans chapter 1, verse 21. Although they knew God, and it would seem this particular atheist had some sense of a super intellect monkeying with physics and with biology, although they knew God, Paul says, they neither glorified him nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal human beings and birds and animals and reptiles. Indeed, Paul says there is a hardness of heart. There is within each human being a willingness to exchange the glory of God and hand it over to created things, whether that be birds or reptiles fashioned in little images that people bow down to. And people still do bow down to images carved of stone. I witnessed that in China and in Korea a few years ago when I visited Buddhist temples there. People standing in front of a Buddha and worshiping that Buddha in some way to get a blessing or a promise from whatever power lay behind that image. People handing over the glory that rightly belonged to God and giving it to images, or perhaps giving it to ideas, giving it to the idea that in wealth and material possessions, then we will find true human fulfillment and satisfaction. Or giving it to the idea that science ultimately will know and explain everything about the created universe. And that we one day will know, in fact, must hold as a firm principle, we cannot ascribe God with the ability to create. No, we must reserve everything in the material world for some scientific explanation. We are prone to worshiping ideas and images. We exchange the glory that rightfully belongs to God, and we infuse created things with this kind of glory, says Paul. And the consequence is a troubling one. Paul goes to some length now, three times, to describe how God gives us over to sinful desires, gives us over to shameful lusts, gives us over to a depraved mind. And what he describes there is creation coming undone. All through these verses, Paul is alluding to the opening chapters in Genesis, the creation story, where we read about God creating all things, making humankind in his image, male and female, and them rebelling and falling into sin. Paul, with echoes to that story, now describes creation coming undone. And surely, if there is one thing that universally human beings can agree on, is that this world is not the way it's supposed to be. Every single human being has some sense that things should be different than the way they are. Certainly, when we witness great atrocities, we all say that. This is not the kind of world that should experience a shaking at its core that causes the death of some 6,000 people in an instant. That's not what this world should be like. This is not the kind of world that should see certain people, because of their religious ideals, beheading other people because of their religious ideals. That's not the way it's supposed to be. This should not be the kind of world where people grow up impoverished when there's an abundance of food to circulate around the planet myriadfold. If there is anything that human beings agree upon, it's that this world is not the way it is supposed to be. Kofi Annan, the former Secretary of the United Nations, in his position as Secretary, visited many, many places in the world and experienced visiting places of deep tragedy and evil, and it shook him. When Annan prays, a Time journalist wrote who interviewed him, when Annan prays, he often wonders about man's cruelty to man. I'm still struggling with evil, he says. I still don't understand how there can be so much evil. You look at the impact. You see young people who have no hope. Annan is most puzzled when he comes face to face with evil, recounting his meetings with former Slobodan or Serbian leader and indicted war criminal Slobodan Milosevic. He says, Milosevic will talk about the days when he was a banker here in New York. He speaks English, sounds like a rational, reasonable person, and yet he is capable of all sorts of acts. How do they do it? How does someone behave like such a normal human being and suddenly turn so evil? He goes on to say, suddenly the moral instinct alone does not answer. You're on your own trying to find direction in a world in which there are no marked paths. You're sitting across from pure evil. What do you do now? Paul offers all of us who read and who are here this day to listen. This world is not the way it's supposed to be. God, in his anger against a rebellious human society, has handed them over to the consequences of their rebellion. He's handed them over to their sinful desires, resulting, as we read, in sexual impurity, degrading their bodies with one another, and exchanging the truth for a lie. Paul says God has handed them over to a freedom that they choose for themselves. And the result is brokenness. The result is brokenness. The result is perversion. God gave them over. What do? They worship created things instead of the God who created them and loved them. God who made a world for them to enjoy and to flourish in. They choose to worship created things, ideas, people, images, animals, nature itself. Can you believe it? Worshiping nature itself instead of the great God who made it all. They worship, Paul says, created things rather than the Creator. And because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts, the second thing. Even their women exchange natural relations for unnatural ones. In the same way, men abandoned natural relations with women and were inflamed for lust with one another. Men committed indecent acts with other men and received in themselves the due penalty for their perversion. What Paul describes in these two verses is an issue that we all know has become a very controversial one in our day. And it's an issue that has not escaped the church itself, wrestling with the understanding of homosexual practice and whether or not God permits it, or whether or not it is something that is a result of a fallen human race that needs to be rescued. We might be tempted to read in these verses, to read them and approach them from a very individualistic way, and we would be wrong to try and do that. One of the things that practicing homosexuals who want to hold on to their Christian faith, one of the things that has been a struggle for them in this passage is to read it as though it was individually directed. And they will say things like, it isn't lust that is consuming me. It's not idolatry that has made me want to have sexual relations with someone of the same gender. It's not a lust that's inflaming me. It's not an idolatry that has motivated me. This is my nature, they will say. And Paul even seems to be saying that what he's angry about is unnatural relations. But we know now that humans are given their homosexual tendencies naturally. And so Paul can't be talking about me. You see, we want to read this from a very individualistic point. And by doing so, in many ways, we miss the mark of what Paul is really driving at here. Paul isn't asking us to read that from an individualistic basis, which our society so quickly wants to do. Paul, remember, there's echoes to the creation story here. What Paul is saying is, when a world gets out of joint, when creation gets out of joint and is misdirected on account of sin, as God hands human beings over to their desire for their freedom, one of the ways in which we see evidence of a creation that's out of joint is that the way God intended sexual intimacy to be experienced between one man and one woman in a lifelong partnership called marriage, that itself gets distorted. That itself goes out of joint. And people engage in unnatural acts. Acts that were not intended from the beginning. People engage in sexual relations that God had not intended for his humanity. Paul describes a society, a culture, that and the existence of homosexual practice is a sign in our culture that the culture as a whole is worshiping idols, and that its God-given male and female order is being fractured as a result. And lest people think Paul is only picking on this sin, lest people think that Paul is only shining the spotlight on this sin, and sadly, too often in the church, that's precisely what we do, is we shine the bright light of judgment on one particular aspect of a broken creation. Paul goes on to describe about how God gave them over to their depraved minds, and he lists one behavior and sin after the other. They have become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They're full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They're gossip, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They are senseless, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do those very things, but also approve of those who practice them. This is bad news indeed. One writer says, when the creature cuts itself off from the Creator, The inevitable result is that the creature can no longer function aright. And so God handed them over to their freedom, the freedom that they yearned for. Not to their freedom to them, he says, but he handed them to their freedom. The control of God, once removed, left them, like a faulty rocket plunging out of control. Now, you know, it's tempting for us. It's tempting for us when we read that catalog of a creation come undone to think, well, Paul's not really talking about me. Paul's not really talking about us. I mean, we live in a culture, in a society that, for the most part, is quite civil. We have infrastructure in place that cares for those who are disadvantaged. We have families that, for the most part, are glued together well, an education system that raises up fairly good citizens, for the most part. We might think societally that Paul isn't talking about us. And yet, Paul's talking precisely about the culture that he lived in, which thought of itself as the epitome of cultures. The Roman emperor had secured a kind of peace for the known world that had beforehand been unexperienced. He was the one that they thought ushered in a peace, the Pax Romana. Indeed, Caesar himself was kind of like a god figure, at least perceived by some as such. There were moralists in Paul's day, pagan moralists, who surely would have thought, Paul, come on, you're being a little extreme now. We're decent people. Come on. And surely, even I suspect for those in the church to whom he was writing in Rome, mainly Gentiles, but some Jews, and for sure the Jews themselves, and Paul goes on now in chapters 2 and 3 to explain that, which I won't do in a lot of detail, but even the Jews themselves must have thought when they heard this, Paul, come on, we are the people of God, we have been given the law, we have the Torah, we have this gift from God that shows us how we ought to live, and because we have the Torah, surely we are a set-apart people. Indeed, we have the circumcision. We've been marked in our own flesh as people who belong to God. We have the law. We have circumcision. Paul, you can't surely be speaking about us. And Paul, in chapters 2 and 3, goes to great length to say, I am not only speaking about Jews, I'm speaking about all people. All people have been infected, corrupted, polluted by sin, which results from a disobedience and a rebellion of those who were made in God's image towards the creation, a rebellion against God. Paul is speaking to all people. And in chapters 2 and 3, he unpacks that in great detail. I guess, as one writer says, here's a question that every single person needs to struggle with. What are human beings? Are we, as many in our society would say, are we fundamentally good creatures whose desires are implicitly to be trusted, including our sexual desires? Are we fundamentally good creatures whose desires are implicitly to be trusted? Or are we both victims and perpetrators of rebellion against our own good? Persistently deceived and deceiving. Paul is saying, in no uncertain terms, it's the latter. He begins chapter 3, or rather in verse 9 of chapter 3, by saying, Jews, Greeks, Gentiles, we're all the same. All of us have fallen as a result of sin. I want to share this, and I'm going to end with this, some excerpts from an essay written by a mother. Her name is Susan. Her son's name was Dylan. You might remember that name. Dylan Klebold was one of two that in 1999 entered into a high school in Columbine and killed 12 students, injured 24 more, and left a whole community, indeed a whole country, in shock. You could imagine that the shock of his mother must have been most heartbreaking. It wasn't until about 10 years after the fact that Susan wrote an essay, first published in Oprah Winfrey's magazine, O, later added or part of a book that she wrote. Susan Klebold wrote about her son Dylan. At one point, she writes, "As a young child, Dylan made parenting easy. From the time he was a toddler, he had a remarkable attention span, a sense of order. He spent hours focused on puzzles and interlocking toys. He loved origami and Lego. By third grade, when he entered a gifted program at school, he had become his father's most devoted chess partner. He and his brother acted out feats of heroism in our backyard. He played Little League baseball. No matter what he did, he was driven to win and was very hard on himself when he lost." As you go through her essay, you see Susan is probably a mom not unlike many of us. We see in our young children so many gifts. We see so much beauty and potential, and we do our very best to nurture that. And she writes about those teenage years. You know those teenage years. They can be a challenge for a lot of parents, including this one. And it's in those teenage years that kids sometimes do things that parents really try to help them avoid. And Susan writes about that. He had some difficulties in school, especially with friends. And at one point, he hated school. He didn't like it. And no doubt it was because he was picked on to some degree. He started dressing different, didn't like all the music that he listened to, didn't like the way he cut his hair. He even got into trouble with the law. But as she continues to write, it's unimaginable that Dylan would do what he ended up doing. Towards the end of the essay, she writes these words, most telling as we listen to this word from Paul. "In raising Dylan, I taught him how to protect himself from a host of dangers, lightning, snake bites, head injuries, skin cancer, smoking, drinking, sexually transmitted diseases, drug addiction, reckless driving, even carbon monoxide poisoning. It never occurred to me that the gravest danger to him, and as it turned out to so many others, might come from within." Now, lest I be perceived as misinterpreting what she wrote, at that point, Susan begins to talk about the thoughts of suicide that Dylan had within him. And she's referring there to suicidal thoughts. But listen to those words again. "It never occurred to me that the gravest danger to him, and as it turned out to so many, might come from within." In chapters 3, verses 9 towards the end, Paul says, "There's nobody living right. Not even one. Nobody knows the score. Nobody's alert to God." I'm paraphrasing with Eugene Peterson. "They've all taken the wrong turn. They've all wandered down blind alleys. No one's living right. I can't find a single one." This makes it clear, says Peterson, that whatever is written in the scriptures is not what God says about others to us, but it's to all of us. What lives within is a rebellion against God, and his love for us and for creation. And Paul wants us to know deep within our being that there is a cure for what lies within, the brokenness of sin. We can be rescued. And without taking the wind out of the sail of next week's sermon, Paul goes on to say, a righteousness of God has been revealed. There is salvation. There is rescue. There is deliverance for all who would believe. And it is announced and given through Jesus Christ and him alone. She ends her essay with these words. Dylan changed everything I believed about myself, about God, about family, about love. I think I believe that if I loved someone as deeply as I loved him, I would know if he were in trouble. My maternal instincts would keep him safe, but I didn't know. And my instincts weren't enough. Our instincts are not enough to cure us. Our instincts about things not being the way they're supposed to be, our instincts about needing a better way, needing a new opportunity, our instincts about looking for something to save us, to make this world better, are not enough. We need a God who has the power to rescue us. We need a God who has demonstrated that power in Jesus Christ, a power over sin and death, a power visibly seen in history through his resurrection. We need a God to save us, and that is precisely what we have. Paul says it. Will you believe it? Let us pray. There are times, O God, when bad news really is good news. When we can look in the mirror and see that the problem doesn't lie outside of us, that the problem isn't their fault or that country's issue. The problem isn't simply out there. But when we confront the bad news, that the problem is within, in our own heart. And when we hear a gracious and loving God write to us, not only on this sacred page, but write to us in the living letter of Jesus, who entered our history and announced a rescue, announced a new freedom, a light, a hope, a peace. Oh God, when we can look in the mirror and then hear that you've done something about that sin within. May every single one of us here this morning bend the knee to Jesus and reach out to the hand that first reached out to us and find a rescue. Oh Lord, search our hearts and turn us again to Jesus. In his name we pray.